This past week, the 2013 Oscar nominations were announced by the Academy, and these awards celebrate the best picture, the best actor and actress, etc., all related to the art of film. Lincoln, the biopic about the 16th president, is leading the way with 12 Academy Award nominations, including Best Director for Steven Spielberg and the Best Actor for Daniel Day-Lewis. I actually want to see that film. Those are two of my favorites. Now, Ang Lee's Life of Pi followed close behind with 11 nominations. Les Misérables and Silver Linings Playbook tied for third place with 8 nominations each. Now, these are arguably the best that Hollywood has to offer at the moment. And so if you're a moviegoer, if you'd like to enjoy a good yarn, I invite you to enjoy the silver screen. It's not normal that these films are offered in all at the same time. You know, the theaters don't normally have such a good range of films worth seeing at the same time. So I encourage you to go if you are an art fanatic or if you enjoy the cinema. Now, there are many kinds of halls of fame that celebrate our culture's best. The Academy Awards are just one form for the entertainment industry. We also have all manners of halls of fame in terms of sports, as well as a chance to celebrate contributions to society and life in general. We have all sorts of halls of fame. Just this past week, there were awards and accolades given by the Vancouver Police Department to police and civilians who displayed bravery and acts of courage during the Vancouver Stanley Cup riots in 2011. You might recall that. Pictured here is Bryn Grierson. She's a nurse who helped an injured woman during the riot. And she is quoted by the Vancouver Sun as saying, I just did something that any nurse would do. I just did something that any nurse would do. In other words, giving first aid and helping is something that any nurse would do in a time of crisis. One would expect medical professionals to help with medical emergencies, right? Yet our city's finest had to make their thanks public in order to underscore the selflessness and bravery that was over and above the call of duty. I can't get over Grierson's response. I just did something that any nurse would do. When it comes to something like faith issues, I wonder if that's how our heroes of the faith would respond to that question. I just did something that a Godfather would do. Our culture celebrates artistic excellence, athletic prowess, and feats of bravery. But how does it celebrate enduring faith in a world filled with cynicism and skepticism? This week's passage celebrates faith, but it doesn't settle on a generalized faith. It focuses on faith in the triune God of Israel. So I invite you at this point to take out your Bibles if you haven't done so and turn with me to the passage that Gord had read so well this morning. Let's go to Hebrews 11, verses 1 to 40. And let's just take a look at verses 1 and 2, the beginning. The writer of Hebrews begins by defining faith, the theological quality that unifies this whole chapter. Verse 1 and 2 read this way. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Now the book of Hebrews, you'll recall, is just one long sermon. And I love how theologian Thomas Long puts it. He says, when the preacher names faith as being sure of what we hope for, he is declaring that it already possesses in the present what God has promised for the future. Let me say that again. Being sure of what we hope for is a declaration of what faith has. It already possesses in the present what God promised for the future. This possession is partly an inward reality, and it's partly an outward force. Inwardly, the people of faith have a confidence today, here, and now, when all hell is breaking loose around them. And the promises of God for peace, justice, mercy, and salvation can actually be trusted. Faith in this inward sense is then a response to the trustworthiness of God. In other words, God can be trusted is what that's saying. But there's a second component to faith. And see that second part of verse 1. Faith is being certain of what we do not see. Now, if the first part of the definition is what faith has, the second part describes what faith perceives. Eyes of faith have a capacity to discern realities not visible to the naked eye. What can be seen, wrote Paul, is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. So we walk by faith and not by sight, from 2 Corinthians 4. There is a difference between what is real and what can be seen. What is real is that Christ is Lord, the heir of all things through whom the world was created, now reigns in majesty. And we understand that in faith as his followers. Now, one of the realities that faith views differently is suffering. And Maya alluded to this. Seen apart from faith, suffering is always destructive. If it's not seen in the eyes of faith, it is seen as always leading to no good end. To be sure, some forms of human suffering, even to the eyes of faith, might seem random or chaotic and meaningless. But faith sometimes has a different view, seeing suffering as a fire that forges steel or as a tilling of the hard ground into the soil of compassion. Now, Maya had alluded to that. It's an opportunity for us to learn, right? Because Jesus himself was tested by what he suffered, the preacher says earlier in this sermon. He is merciful and able to help those who are being tested. And you'll find that in Hebrews 2:18. Under the pressure of testing and suffering, the naked eye can only see the oppressor, the pain. We can only see the tyranny of a dictatorial state, or the scars of child abuse, or the x-rays on the spot on the lung. Now, faith sees all that, to be sure. It does not pretend that there is no Pharaoh, no evil, or no disease. But faith also sees God, the God who promises to bring an end to all the harms and destroys, and the God who provided a great high priest who in every respect has been tested as we are, and who enables us to receive mercy and to find grace to help in time of need. I want to talk to you about a fellowship within our conference. The Mennonite Brethren in Colombia understand this truth about faith and being able to look at faith through the eyes of faith. Daily, they lay their lives on the line for peace and for justice and for reconciliation. On September 21st, in this past year, the International Day of Peace coincides with the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly. On that day, Anabaptist churches across Colombia gathered in public places to celebrate the annual Bread and Peace campaign. Sharing both bread and their daily commitment to nonviolence, they sang and spoke in public, demonstrating the everyday implications of peace building in contexts of great violence and dire hunger. Now, the annual International Day of Peace campaign began in 2002, so 10 years prior to that, when the United Nations asked the Colombian Mennonite churches to lead a public celebration to commemorate a day for ceasefire and nonviolence. The church had already gained recognition for its commitment to nonviolence through campaigns for including conscientious objection to mandated military service in the 1991 Constitution. God treasures obedience and faithfulness. You have to understand that there was an overwhelming amount of violence between the Colombian army and the drug cartel paramilitary forces. They were constantly fighting, and many, many civilians were the collateral damage. They were killed amongst the gunfire. But the government was pressuring all Colombians in this war against drugs to become active collaborators of the state armed forces. And those who refused were labeled traitors. Those who refused to take up arms on behalf of the government were labeled guerrilla supporters. In other words, you are enemies of the state. In other words, if you're not going to sign up with us, you're just one of those terrorists. All three Anabaptist denominations in Colombia, the Mennonite Brethren, the Mennonites, and the Brethren in Christ, they all felt significant pressures, sometimes at the threat of violence. They decided to make visible their position for nonviolence. And they did this by publishing a bold statement in the national newspaper, kind of like putting it in the Globe and Mail. And they declared that as followers of Christ, we affirm our biblical and historical commitment to walk the path of peace, nonviolence. We refuse to participate in any armed group. And we refuse also to pay so that others do so on our behalf. Do you understand what they're saying? We're standing up for peace. And you know what, government? We're even going to withhold some of our taxes that's going towards funding your military operations. Boy, that got them in trouble. They went on to declare that seeking peace with justice involved conversations and actions with whomever is willing to consider nonviolent negotiated solutions. They're saying, let's come to the table, let's talk. All those who are interested in peace, let's talk. In other words, they rejected the government's framing of who is friend and who is traitor. Indeed, they called on the government and the armed groups and the media to give up their warlike attitudes and to begin genuine peace talks with real concessions toward the building of a new country. That was back in 1991, 20 years. They took risks and remained faithful to their calling as agents of peace and ambassadors for Christ. And the United Nations took note of this. They were seen as agents of peace. Now, this and other public statements have played a fundamental role in protecting the lives of Anabaptist church leaders in Colombia. And I want to just share one of the examples here. There are Mennonite Brethren churches in Choco, and you'll see that it's a small rural community in western Colombia. That whole province is called Choco, and that's close to the border of Panama. They run community rice processing plant. So the community will farm and harvest rice, and then they'll process it together at this plant. And the churches run that plant. When heavily armed paramilitary groups pressured them at gunpoint and threat of death, and worse, just terrible pain, they said, "You must pay us a war contribution." In other words, give us some money so we can fight. Church leader Pastor Rutilio Rivas risked his life by responding firmly. Mennonite churches have been committed to nonviolence and peace building for centuries. We will not support any armed groups, not even the state armed forces. And we will not support you, even if it costs us our lives. Surprised by this boldness and aware that the Mennonites in Colombia have held this position throughout time, the paramilitary commander actually promised to respect this position. And you'll have to understand, this is a drug cartel warrior, one hired by the drug cartels to say, "Look, go drum up some business, even if that means killing some people to get the money so we can fight the government's forces." This commander promised to respect the position of the Anabaptists. Well, in 1997, the Columbia Mennonite Biblical Seminary was being threatened by the government. So now it's the government forces threatening the Columbia Mennonite Biblical Seminary. They were threatening to close its whole program. And why was that? Due to its program of peace studies, which allowed many students to declare themselves as conscientious objectors to military service. North American churches then sent hundreds of letters to top government authorities, and guess what happened? The seminary stayed open. I'm not sure if any of you were part of that. And then in 2004, Colombian Mennonite church leader and human rights lawyer Ricardo Esquivia, was being threatened with detainment on serious but false charges. Again, the international Christian community responded with 1,000 faxes, okay, not emails, but faxes, because that was before email was vogue, and then letters sent to the Colombian government. Then when Colombia's vice president called Ricardo in for a conversation, he greeted Ricardo with a huge stack of letters. And the words, Mr. Akivia, you seem to have a lot of friends. Thousands of letters. Ricardo was not detained or imprisoned, and God treasures obedience and faithfulness. Now, that isn't always the peaceful solution. Sometimes there are times when people are imprisoned, and there was that as well. But the church in Colombia understands what faith means in the context of suffering. Bino Clarín, so do we. There are many saints from Clarín Park who have gone ahead of us over the past 3 years to join the faithful in glory. They understood suffering. Ursula Dyke, Peter Enns, Kay Giesbrecht, Peter Heinrichs, Mary Klippenstein, Neil Newman, Martha Plett, Helen Rempel, and our dear Kay Unger. Some of these saints truly understood suffering, especially in their last days. All of them lived lives that speak of their faithfulness to our God. Once again, God treasures obedience and faithfulness. Now, we all have the same choice that our brothers and sisters in Colombia face, that all those mentioned in the Hall of Faith also faced. Do we stay in the family of God, where day in and day out there is opportunities to endure suffering and testing? We're exposed to a weary struggle against discouragement and sin. We live in a very Christian negative culture. It's always critiquing Christianity, always wanting to see the goods before them. It's difficult to have eyes of faith in our culture. Do we stay in this family of God, claiming faith? Or do we walk out those church doors and keep God from molding our hearts and just say, you know what? What you see is what you get. That's our challenge, brothers and sisters. God treasures obedience and faithfulness. Let's remain faithful to our faithful God. That's my prayer for us. It's at this point today that I want to allow for a little bit of interaction. We don't have tons of time, but I want to allow for some Q questions and A, the Canadian way of saying A. I want to open this floor up to allow some general questions regarding the passage, and if there's something in this passage that you're struggling with, or if there's something that you want to ask about, or if you have something to contribute, please, now would be the time. Louis, would you grab that cordless mic and offer to anyone who might have something to contribute at this time? Maybe there's just something that jogged your memory, or picked some curiosity. I offer you this time now to contribute. Now, one of the caveats is, I might not have all the answers, but I will commit to finding those for you, given time. But someone else might actually have an answer as well, here within the fellowship. So please, don't hold back any questions. Comments? Yes, Linda. Would you take the mic to Linda, please?
There probably is no answer to this, but I've always wondered about this passage about Sarah. It says here, and by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was unable to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And I remember in the story it said that Sarah laughed when she heard that she was going to have a baby at the age of 90. And so to me that doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah, you know, she initially did, didn't she? And she even argued, I didn't laugh. And the voice that answers it, yes, you did. Called her to account, right? But she did carry the baby to term. And I think this hope and faith wasn't just I got it, God, yeah, I'm believing you. I think it was a journey. And she had 9 months to begin really believing as she felt this baby growing within her. You know, it really is a wrestle. Every woman who becomes pregnant wrestles with this. Is this baby going to come to term? Right? Many of us have dealt with miscarriages in our families. And so every single baby is a miracle. And I think for her, wow, even more so because she was in her later years. But she had 9 months, and God gave her that chance, right? I mean, even her husband. He had proof positive that he had no faith because he couldn't speak. That was his test. Yes. Neil.
The problem for me is the sheer horror of trouble.
Yeah.
Well, how do we as Christians help each other when it's really horrible? You know, when someone is sawn in two, you do feel, well, what do I do? How do I help? Now, there's probably a clue in the fact that Jesus suffered in chapter 2, right? So that he could understand.
Yeah.
But it's actually, what do you do when someone is sawn in two? What do we as a community do?
And I think connected to that is the fear of experiencing the same. If I stand for faith, is that going to happen to me as well? So that's always something that's quite sobering. But it is a feeling of powerlessness, isn't it? When we can't actually do something. And so then what does it mean when we are weak that he is strong? That's a difficult question, Neil. There's no easy answers to that. Al.
I agree there's no easy answers, but Abraham and Sarah had to go to bed, right? I mean, this was not an immaculate conception.
Yeah.
And so at 90, they were going to bed. People get sawed in half, I understand. It's it's horrible, and I'm not sure. I guess all I want to say is I think that their faith is more to do with a presence than it does in even your word obedience. I'm not sure it leads to the right type of obedience. Because in my understanding, as I grew up in the faith, it was more if you were if you did everything right, you're going to be okay. Hmm. So part of what's happening here is going against our culture, not so much, you know, in the big pictures of things like peace and violence, but also in the sense of how they perceive. When we follow a God who says he loves us, what will that mean? And when our children are taken from us before their birth, how do we follow at that point? Well, it's a one day at a time. It's our whole lives. I mean, he's sort of put our whole lives into a context of loss. So you get pushed out of the womb, you get pushed out of kindergarten, you get pushed out of high school, you get pushed out of university, you may get pushed out of your first job, you may get pushed out of your marriage. I mean, it's all, Walter Wangerin Jr. has a great book called Mourning, M-O-U-R-N, Into Dancing, where he talks about that this is sort of the pattern of life. So I'm not, and I hear Neil's question. You're like, what do? You see it, and I'm not sure there's anything to do. You can't plan ahead in this stuff. I don't think. Well, maybe you do plan ahead by trying to be faithful, sort of on a as each day comes. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that there's going to be someone who says, okay, well here, although we might like it, here's the manual, and just follow this, and everything will be okay. You know what? There ain't no manual. Even the scriptures are confusing and upsetting at times. It's more about how we how we get more intimate with this God and with his mystery. Anyways, no answer.
Yeah, one of the things I'm wondering is, I think the question that Neil had raised, we're always the ones who assume the locus of control, right? We're always thinking that we can do something as we respond. How can we be of help? How can we be of service? How can we help that family that just lost that father who was torn in two? And, you know, we have some very pragmatic examples within our own fellowship. One of our preschool students lost a dad. It was the same night of the preschool Christmas concert. After the concert, they went home, and the dad had a heart attack, and he was only 41. You're right. As Christians, we're not guaranteed. We're not guaranteed the next day, the next moment, even if we do everything right. Right. And what then? What do we do? How do we support that family, which has three young kids and a mom? How do we support that? How do we respond to that? And how do we say, oh, you know, have faith? That sounds so trite in the time of emergency and circumstance, doesn't it? And yet I think we still need to rally around. And I'm glad that their church did rally around this family to be a support. And we're Christ's hands and feet during that time. But when we're facing serious persecution, and let's say paramilitaries walk through here and take some of us away, and some of us are sawn in two, how do we actually respond? That's a hard question, because we don't understand that. This generation of North Americans don't understand that. But our brothers and sisters in Colombia do. And our brothers and sisters in Syria do, and in Egypt they do, and in China they certainly do. And we need to get those stories out to say faith is still alive, God is still on the throne, and guess what? He still does reward faithfulness in adversity. But it is hard to respond during those serious times of calamity that we have no control over. And there is no textbook. I don't want to belabor this, so I want to close us with a blessing. Thank you, Louis, for being a microphone holder. And thank you for responding and interacting. I appreciate that. Let me close us with this thought. Consider it the pre-benediction benediction. My hope is that as we remain faithful to a faithful God, may our response to adversity, to suffering and injustice be, I just did something that any God follower would do. May we continue to live in faith. And may we continue to have hope in a God who interestingly has a hope in us. Thanks be to God. Amen.